Hey there, and welcome to Money for Change, the podcast where we dive into the sustainability transitions that are reshaping our world. If you're curious about where the planet and its inhabitants are headed, you're in the right place. In each episode, we'll chat with experts from Triodos Bank, whose work relates to these changes, tackling topics like the energy transition, circular economy, and what sustainable finance really means. Our goal? To bring you the latest insights on what it takes to create a more balanced and just world. But we don't just want you to listen. We want you to be a part of the conversation. Head over to our website via the link in the show notes to share your thoughts, ask a question, or leave us a voice message. Welcome to Money for Change. Let's get started. Welcome to a new episode of Money for Change. Today we will be talking about critical raw materials. As always, we do it with Hans Tegeman. Welcome, Hans.
Thank you.
And we have the pleasure and honor of introducing Mattia Kajic here. She works as a sustainability researcher for Triodos, and she does research into the resource and energy transition. Welcome, Mattia. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me, and nice to see you outside of our usual work context.
Likewise, likewise. To start off this episode, Mattia, I would like to ask you, what are critical raw materials?
So critical raw materials basically are very valuable raw input materials for various technological and industry processes in our economies. We use them for a whole host of applications. We use them in electric cars, in conventional cars, for solar, wind, nuclear projects, all kinds of electronics, semiconductors, really a whole host of applications. And I think the name itself tells us a lot about what they are. So you've got the raw materials part. It tells us these are natural resources. Predominantly, it's metals like lithium, cobalt, nickel, but also rare earth elements, minerals, and one gas. But the thing that makes it really interesting for our conversation today is that critical part. So what does it mean that they are critical? It means that economies around the world have basically realized that this is a vital asset to make their economies function for the renewable energy transition, for their electronics. And basically, they're all on a rush to secure these materials so that they can continue to use them in all the applications that I listed. But what makes it difficult is that there are vulnerabilities in their supply chains. So they're not always easy to secure, either because the material itself is scarce or because there are geopolitical tensions around them. So for example, we're overly dependent on only one actor for the processing or the mining. So that's what makes them critical.
And that's always with the word critical. That's what I learned over the years. That's what you say. So critical depends on the demands, but critical depends also on the supply, and critical also depends on technology. So if you can find substitutes for certain critical raw materials, then suddenly there's no demand.
Yeah.
And then they can get off the list. And that's what happened over the years, that also that year of critical raw materials changes over time.
So I think, Hans, you're touching upon something here, right? Because what we do is essentially we look into the future, we try to imagine what it is that we're going to need, and then we come up with what raw materials might be critical, so what we might be lacking. Could you elaborate a little bit how the EU is faring in this geopolitical race that Mattia just alluded to?
Not that well.
Okay.
To start with, and of course it starts with your own supply. And well, that's the main vulnerability. Europe has more, but this is one big vulnerability if you talk about critical raw materials. So what you're going to do if you see that you lack the source, the raw material itself, then you go into other strategies like a circular economy, trying to reduce your demands, trying to be efficient. And I think resource efficiency, Europe is championing resource efficiency in general. So that's a strategy to combat that problem. And of course, you're going to mine yourself in Europe. And that is quite difficult because, well, land is expensive. We have a lot of people here. And mining is always polluting. So, and that's also typical European. We don't want to have that here. So you have a few strategies that you can use. And that's what Europe is doing to mitigate your problem. The core is still that you lack a lot of those materials yourself.
Yeah, they remain really critical.
They remain critical, yes.
Urgent sense of the word.
China would have another list or not.
So yeah, maybe Mattia, to ask you, because I hear Hans here, he says that we don't want to mine in the EU, but could we mine? Are all these materials available in the EU?
There definitely are some reserves of these materials in the EU as well. So Sweden, Finland, Norway, Spain, there are smaller reserves. But I would also highlight, of course, as Hans was saying, this issue of we don't want to have the mining here. But I think another big problem is that we don't want to have the processing here as well. So I think for China, the reserves of these critical raw materials are about something like less than 40% of the reserves are in China. But 85% of the processing is in China. So they are really willing to take on the environmental risks of the processing, which is also highly polluting, as the mining is, that Hans was saying. So the processing is highly polluting. China is willing to take on the environmental risks of it. And they also have been doing this for the past two decades. So they've really developed their expertise on it as well. And they hold way more patents than any other part of the world for processing, right, especially of REEs. So then that's
and
another
REEs
reason why. Rare earth elements. So
right,
generally for critical raw materials, China has a lot of patents here, but specifically for rare earth elements, they have more of them. And that's why
the difference between critical raw materials and rare earth elements?
Critical raw materials are a broader category,
yeah,
so they include rare earth elements.
Okay.
And rare earth elements are some of these metalloids that are included,
yeah,
in the broader.
So they all have these rare earth elements, they all have names that to me sound like science fiction movies, right? So
yeah,
the one I always remember is neodymium.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds a bit like The Matrix to me.
And I said metalloids, but I meant metallic elements. Sorry, for any scientists listening.
Thank you. Okay, so we have raw materials, mostly metals, that we get from the earth that we need for a lot of different technologies, electric cars, solar panels, but also our defense industry, our phones and our laptops. AI uses it a lot. But almost all of them currently are not mined in Europe. And even when we could mine things in Europe, most production happens in China or other parts of the world.
The processing at the very least. So getting them to that high purity state that they need to be able to go into all of these applications.
Right.
Yeah.
And I know it's critical, but how big are the shortages we're talking? Is it going to be a little bit tight, or do we really lack a lot of materials in the future? Do we have any idea?
I think that if we look to urban mining, which is the extraction of these materials from waste streams, from infrastructure, so from the materials that we have in our cities already, I've seen research saying for like 25 to 30% of our future reserves, of our future need, so about in 2050, about 25 or 30% of our need could come from urban mining or mining from existing mine waste.
Right.
But there will still be a need to mine before that. And what I would advocate for there is first looking into mines that are currently existing but have not been fully mined. So because it was no longer economically profitable, we've got mines in Canada and in Australia that have not been completely mined because of high operational costs and the low cost of the material itself. So I would look to those first. I would look to urban mining, mining from waste streams. And then if we had to start with new mines, I would look to, as much as possible, these small scale and eco-certified mines.
Yeah, but so it sounds 25 to 30% is really little, right? That
yeah,
means that one in four phones or cars that you would want to produce can actually be made.
That's always a difficulty with this kind of question, right? So
yeah,
so what's the shortage? That depends, well, still an economist, on demand and supply and on substitution you can get. So you could also say, okay, as an economist, I would say, okay, if we don't have any supply, we get substitution because we get a high price and we find something else and then it will go on. Strict economic assumptions are that if the price goes high, there will always be a substitution possible and everything goes on. I think it will not be always, but there is, of course, a certain point where you get substitution effects, especially in materials,
mm-hmm,
which is different from nature itself. That's another story, but in materials. So the demand side is a little bit unpredictable. What we know, and that was what also Mattia was saying, from circular, so from urban mining or recycling or that kind of, that's, I saw something that's maximum 40% in total. That's not only critical earth materials, but everything. That means that you always have to mine more stuff, probably, depending on your demand. But in every scenario, and especially, for instance, the energy transition, you need a lot of exactly those materials.
Yeah.
And there's another thing, and of course, in every episode, I have to say something about it. There's also on the assumption that the economy should grow, because what determines the demand, that's economic growth. And if you bring that together, you see, if you say, yeah, the world economy has to grow and we can do a lot with recycling, with other sufficiency, so we reduce a little bit of demand in some areas, then still we need more resources in general. And that's where we are.
Okay, so that's a lot to unpack, Hans. Thanks for that. But I also hear you say, indeed, we can change demand. So maybe some of these raw materials, we can actually use another one that's less critical. But I also heard you say somewhere between the lines that supply will expand, to speak in economist language, right? That if these materials become more expensive, that maybe we will mine in more places. Mattia, do you think that sounds like a good idea to just make all these raw materials more expensive and then to mine on a lot more locations because all of a sudden it's now profitable?
Yeah, I've heard different interpretations around this, and I think definitely Hans can chime in more here than myself. But I wanted to say that in the context of the renewable energy transition, we actually don't know if it would be better to mine in a lot of different places. At the moment, the type of mining and the type of processing that's going on, it's relatively cheap, and different countries across the world, including developing economies, can purchase solar panels, can purchase wind turbines for their economies. Whereas if we hugely diversify these supply chains, it will increase the price, right, of these products, and then it might not be so attractive and we might not be able to achieve our renewable energy goals, at least not all countries. So I think that's also something to keep in mind.
Yeah, so indeed, if we actually make all these materials more expensive, then maybe it'll set us back even in economic activity.
But it would make the mines that I was mentioning earlier that were previously closed, it would make them viable again. So then you wouldn't be looking for the business case in deep sea mining, but you could make a business case for the existing landmines.
Right.
So there's give and take.
So I hear Hans is saying that if just raw materials become more expensive, then maybe we will find more of them. I hear Mattia saying, well, if that
happens, we get substitution.
Yeah.
I hear Mattia rightly saying, if it really becomes more expensive, maybe we will just buy less as well.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a good thing? Because then we need less of the raw materials, right? I kind of see only positives. If the raw materials are more expensive, there less people want them. We can find them in more places.
There are two stories on it. So this is the one is it's getting more expensive to mine them. So they will be more expensive because there's more demand and supply. It's simply a market price that goes up. A second thing is let's price also the externalities of mining.
Right.
So the price should go up. Exactly, to use less of it and to increase well-being in total. Because if you price externality, so the negative effects of mining in the supply chain, labor conditions, etc., then it will become more expensive to mine and that will have the same kind of effect.
So what are those negative effects? You just mentioned labor conditions.
So the pollution, which goes hand in hand with not only mining, but I think you know more processing. I think it's
so
worse.
The tailings at mines, there's a huge amount of pollution from that. It leaches into the groundwater. Then with the processing,
and
you've
the tailings
got,
is what you have left over.
Exactly, the leftovers from the mining process. It's made into a kind of slurry and usually left in a pond on the mining site. You've got these from coal ash, from any kind of mining.
So that's like someone in the city just throwing their trash on the street.
Indeed, exactly, and leaving it there. And the funny kind of paradox about it is that a lot of the materials from old mining that were left over are now precisely the materials that we want. So in the coal ash tailings, you've got rare earth elements, which is what we want for our technologies now. So we're not interested in the coal so much anymore, but we are interested in those rare earth elements.
So you need someone to excavate all the trash that old miners have produced.
And then you have the benefit of it being in these old coal mining towns, which are now kind of struggling in different economic ways. And then you've got the benefit of improving the environment conditions so that there is less of this leaching, less of the earth pollution, less of the air pollution. And you've got the additional benefit of getting the materials that you want. So that's why it's always better to look to these rather than virgin.
So we can now use some of the excess waste, but there's always when you mine waste that is toxic or harmful in some way. And then on top of that, there's poor labor conditions, right? And a lot of mines with danger for people.
Yeah.
Hans?
We left a story when we said, the price can go higher
should go higher
of critical raw materials for demand and for the external effects we just talked about. And that would probably be more efficient for the world. Yeah. However, well, you get a lot of redistribution effects because who gets what money? And then there's one continent where we also started with, which probably doesn't get the money but has to pay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's us.
Right.
So I think, although it might seem that we are very sustainable as Europe, this is not the strategy we want to reduce our problems with critical raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we also started in the beginning saying, yeah, but this is not what we want. We do other stuff. We try to be more efficient and use less and recycle, et cetera. And it's in our own interest as Europe to pursue that kind of strategies instead of saying, hey, we're going to pay more. Right. Because then we have to pay more.
Right. So you're saying probably Europe cannot pay the real price of critical raw materials.
We will not pay the real price. But we will not.
Okay, let's come back to that in a bit.
And if we would have to do that, then we're going to intensify our innovation searches and we try to reduce our... So we're going to also go a lot... So that's the best way for a circular economy strategy in Europe is that we have to pay the real price.
Right, yeah. Make it more expensive. And then we get to a circular economy, hopefully. Mattia, what can we realistically expect? You did a PhD on circular economy. How much can I or someone listening to this podcast hope that we will be able to solve with circular economy in terms of critical raw materials?
Well, I think that goes back to the point that Hans and I were making earlier, that it's relatively a small fraction of the future demand that you were asking for. So as I said, 25, 30, Hans brought up 40%. Right. So it's a relatively small amount. And I do think that we need to look at ways to innovate to make sure that we can do the urban mining. So product design is a part of this so that this recovery of materials is easier. But I don't think that for this specific problem, the circular economy will be able to solve.
Let's be more optimistic. You're right on this part of the circular economy, which is really on the recycling, urban mining part. Yes, yeah. this is still keeping the rest of the economy as it is.
Mm.
So we do still fast fashion. We still do a lot of stuff which is not sustainable.
You only use the waste of the existing.
We only use what we call in circular economy the lower R strategy. So recycling a little bit, recovery, that kind of stuff. But if we go to the upper parts of the strategy, so what can you really do in a circular economy? Make less products.
Right.
Yeah. Why should you make products that nobody needs? Make products that really last much longer.
Yeah.
It's the best strategy to use less raw materials.
Yeah.
So if you go to that higher R strategies, then you get more impact and then you can reduce your critical.
But Hans, if these materials are critical and we can make products that last longer, why don't we do it yet?
Hey, we have a market economy and you want to make profits, right? And so if you go to an entrepreneur and you say, hey, you can make fantastic products, and they last for, let's say, instead of 5 years, 10 years, and they, for the same price, then a consumer would want it, but an entrepreneur will not make it. There's a famous story on the first lamp,
the light bulb
in the 1920s of the last century.
Yeah.
So they made one that could burn for 100 years.
Right.
They did not produce it.
No.
Because, there you go with your profits.
Yeah.
And that's the core of the problem of this. As long as you have the profit incentive dependent on turnover of a company, why should you make products that last forever?
Yeah.
And that's essentially the problem,
that
we face.
People trying to make profit. It's nice that we ended here while you started saying you would be optimistic in this answer.
This is optimistic. Yeah. People don't understand. If you make... I always take the refrigerator. Don't know why. Always take the refrigerator. If you make an economy with only refrigerators,
mm-hmm.
and the refrigerator that is bought can last instead of 1 year, 2 years. Yeah. Make it very simple.
Mm-hmm.
For the same price. What will happen to economic production? It will halve.
Half, at least for refrigerators.
Yeah, but we only have refrigerators. So we have half. But what will happen to consumers?
They will need only half their income to buy refrigerators.
Yeah. And they have the same kind of utility from a refrigerator.
Yeah.
And that's the mistake people often make, only looking at economic production. No, you have to look at well-being.
Yeah.
And you have then products, as much utility, so you can do as much with the stuff you have, because it lasts longer, so you need to buy less and you're as happy.
Yeah.
And in this case, not only the well-being of the people buying the refrigerators, but if we're sticking with our mining example, the communities where the mining is happening. So they carry all the environmental burden, and it should be an initial part of the planning to ensure that some of the revenue at least stays in those communities where the mining is actually happening, who are paying the environmental and public health costs. Yeah.
So this is a very optimistic story.
Thank you. Thank you both for inspiring me today. I have one more question, because I hear critical raw materials and we don't have a lot of them. And I hear you speaking about how Europe can sort of get back in the race with the US and with China. But how about all the other countries in the world? So shouldn't we be targeting to have something like a carbon budget where we divide the materials that are still left, and do developing economies get enough access to these critical raw materials? Does anyone, Hans?
What we see in the world in terms of geopolitics is a more multipolar world where everything, every trade relationship is used for power. And so you can also see last week we had the Mercosur agreement between, this is really a sidestep, but whatever.
Let's not do the sidestep. There's power in global trade.
Yeah, it's important to understand that every trade relationship is about power. So also if the Europe wants to have a trade relationship with South America, it's about power and see what do I get out of it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have money, it's very simple, you don't have power.
Right.
And in that sense, you can see all the struggle. So this is the history of economics, right? So where do I get the cheapest labor resources, energy sources? Where do I get it the cheapest?
Yeah.
And who asks that question? That's the one with power and with money. So the answer is very simple.
They're not being taken into account in the race.
No.
And I guess, Mattia, tell me if you agree with this, but the only sort of optimistic strategy would indeed be to use less resources in the global north.
Indeed, use less resources in the global north. And I think it's important to highlight, to Hans's previous point, that none of the other nice examples that I've listed, urban mining, the waste tailings mining, none of that makes sense unless we reduce the consumption in the global north of both energy and of resources. So it's only once we move closer to that we can start making use of these alternative strategies. And then you don't have to mine on the moon and mine on the deep sea.
That sounds very outlandish, but that's clear. Thank you. Thank you both very much. And I hope that people realize that you still want them to have a fridge, but just for it to last much longer.
Longer, indeed.
All right, Hans. You've been reading the news, as you always do. Yes. What was the biggest news for you last week?
Let's talk about Europe again and French politics. We saw last week that the government was sacked by Parliament on December the 4th. And the Prime Minister, Michel Barnier, tried to force through his budget and he failed.
Right. Is that why he was sacked?
Well, we have three big blocks in the French Parliament, left, extreme right, and the middle. So there's no majority, whatever, for this government. And this was forced by Macron. This is not too many sidesteps. But what we saw on the markets, and this was also a few weeks before that, we saw also in Germany almost the same happening for a different reason. And we saw no reaction on the markets, on the financial markets. And to explain our listeners, what you see when there's trouble with the government budget, you see quite often that the interest rate goes up.
Right.
And then economists, you look always at the 10 years, so what a government pays for its 10 years bond.
Right. And that's also how it matters to people listening, right? So your government needs to pay more interest.
Yeah. And what we saw last week, that for the first time ever, I don't know for the first time ever, but for the first time since a long period, France had to pay the same amount for the 10 years as the Greek governments. And this is quite remarkable because, well, many of you know, we had a euro crisis and then France was always a little bit more on the northern side than on the southern side. So not that they were like Germany or the Netherlands, but not in the danger zone. And this is quite remarkable that we see this happening on financial markets. We see, like I said before, Germany having no government, having elections, we see France in trouble. So I think what the market is now reacting to is not only the French fiscal position, so the global debt in France, the debt in France is 125% of GDP, which is quite high. But that's not necessarily a problem. The problem is the Eurozone itself.
Right.
We have a lot going on. We have a war very close by. We need to step up our defense spending. We need to do a lot also in Europe. And the two biggest countries don't have a government at the moment.
Right.
And I think financial markets are more looking into that now.
Yeah. So you don't think France is going bankrupt, but you think...
No, France is not going bankrupt.
Right.
I also looked into... So China, did you know that China and the US, since the financial crisis, doubled their debt, and they're also not going to get bankrupt.
No.
I think it's getting all the trouble. That's a different episode, maybe, all those debts, but that's not the problem. I think the problem is the Eurozone and the structure of the Eurozone, and that is not so hopeful news.
Right. No, and that ties very well into what you and Mattia have been telling me in the first part of this episode, namely that on critical raw materials, Europe is not doing so well. Luckily, you offered a hopeful perspective, where if we just make sure that we make our products last longer, we will need less of those.
Yeah.
Raw materials in general.
And maybe also a point on this for our Dutch friends here. The Netherlands is the fifth economy of the Eurozone. And our debt, government debt, is, I think, 43%. So we have a moral obligation in the Netherlands to speed up our investments in innovation, education, research, and whatever for the future of Europe and to help our French friends.
That's a great call to action. We need more investment in education in the Netherlands. I hope the government hears it. We're in a discussion at the moment. Hans and Mattia, I want to thank you both for this contribution to Money for Change. And we'll be back next week with another episode. That's a wrap for this episode of Money for Change. We hope you found today's conversation insightful and inspiring as we continue to explore the transitions that are shaping our world and our future. If you enjoyed what you heard, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for tuning in to Money for Change.